The meeting will come to order. We don't yet have a quorum, so we will get started and then approve the minutes when we do have a quorum. And we have the luxury today, members, of having two wonderful resource people who will share with us some big picture thinking on the achievement gap. We will follow up with the hearing that Representative Mariani had this morning, that actually only five or six of us are on that committee as well. So there might be a little bit of repeat, but with different people for the few people that are on both committees. But it bears repeating because this is our main focus this session, to try to look at all the things that we do and how much money we're spending on them and see what will actually get the most bang for the buck. Where could we do the most good to prepare all of our Minnesota students for success? So the first speaker that we'll spend about half the time with is Dan Mueller, who is Dr. Dan Mueller from Wilder Research Center. He's an associate director, and he has more than 25 years of experience doing research in the area of human services, including evaluating many educational programs and demonstration projects. And he's currently involved in several outcome effectiveness studies of programs designed to increase the likelihood of student success among children in high-risk circumstances. He received his doctorate in sociology from Yale University. Dr. Mueller, I'm going to have you restate your name and title for the committee tape. And welcome to the committee. I will let you know when you have 10 minutes left of your presentation, because legislators love to ask questions.
All right. Thank you. My name is Dan Mueller, Associate Director of Wilder Research. And, okay. Well, thank you.
Welcome.
Madam Chairperson, committee members, and guests, I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you this afternoon about the achievement gap. The title of my presentation is Tackling the Achievement Gap Head On. I believe tackling the achievement gap and closing it could be critical to the future economic vitality and quality of life in Minnesota. In my presentation, I will briefly address the following questions regarding the achievement gap. What is it? How large is the gap? Why is the gap important? What factors contribute to the gap? And how can the gap be closed? First, what is it, or what do we mean by the achievement gap? The key areas of achievement being considered in my presentation are proficiency in core academic subjects, so such as reading and math and writing. Areas are students developing solid skills in these areas, graduation from high school, and enrollment and success in college or other post-secondary programs. When we look at these three areas of achievement, large differences or gaps are seen by family income levels of students and race ethnicity. Family income is defined by free and reduced price lunch for purposes of this analysis. So low income refers to students who qualify for free or reduced lunch, and that means their families have incomes below 185% of the poverty level. Non-low income or higher income students are those who don't qualify for free or reduced lunch and whose families have incomes greater than 185% of poverty. Students from high-income families tend to have higher achievement, as we'll see. With regard to race ethnicity, large gaps exist between the achievement of white students and students of color, African-American, Hispanic, and American Indians, with whites having higher achievement. Asian students tend to be more similar to white students statewide, especially with regard to high school graduation and college graduation. These two factors overlap a great deal locally. Over 80% of students of color in St. Paul schools, for example, and probably Minneapolis as well, are from low-income families. As we will see in a minute, the achievement gap is very striking, both locally and nationally. A recent book that looks specifically at white, black, and Hispanic students put it this way: overstating the achievement gap is not easy. The difference in educational attainment between white students on the one hand and African-American and Hispanic students on the other hand is large and persistent. If the achievement gap could be reduced, the fortunes of black and Hispanics would not only be raised, but the social and economic differences that intensify the country's racial tensions would be ameliorated. And we could, of course, add American Indian students to the black and Hispanic students as well. That quote was from Bridging the Achievement Gap, a book edited by John Chubb and Tom Lovelace. How large is the gap? Next, we'll turn to some information on the achievement, the size of the achievement gap. First, to national data, comparing Minnesota to the United States overall, and then second, to some data from the St. Paul schools to help fill out the picture of the achievement gap. Before starting, I should note that the achievement gap begins well before a child enters school. We see large differences in skills by income and race when children enter kindergarten. The data for Minnesota and the nation overall are based on the 2005 results of the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or as it's referred to, the NAEP. First, we look at achievement results by family income. Results for students with low incomes below 185% of poverty, and then those with higher incomes above 185% of poverty. If you look at the table, results are shown for fourth grade reading and eighth grade math. The figures shown are the percentage proficient or above in the subject. Note that for Minnesota, 22% of low-income fourth graders were proficient in reading compared to 45% of higher-income fourth graders, so a gap of 23 percentage points in proficiency in reading at the fourth grade level. The results for the United States overall are similar, but the percentages proficient are somewhat lower than in Minnesota. The pattern in eighth grade math is similar. The percentages of higher income students proficient is more than double that for low income students, 50% versus 22% in Minnesota. Similar gap in the United States, but the percentages are somewhat lower. One thing I want to note about the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or the NAEP, the standard for proficiency is quite high, so you can see that even that the percentages that are proficient are not all that high, even for the higher income students in this case. And so they tend to be higher than the state definitions of proficiency, including those for Minnesota. If we looked at with the NAEP, there's really four categories: below basic, basic, proficient, and advanced. If we look at students who are at the basic level or advanced, the percentages would be considerably higher. So, for example, in reading in fourth grade, 78% of higher income students in Minnesota are at the basic level or better, and 54% are at the low income of students that are proficient. Or not proficient, but at the basic level or above. So I just wanted to point that out, but the patterns are the same. In other words, the gaps are approximately the same.
Dr. Miller, I think we have one question. Yes. Members, I think that by and large we'll have the questions at the end, but I'm going to take Representative McFarland's question.
Okay.
And if anybody has a question of clarification, go ahead and ask it as he goes through. But otherwise, except for this question, we're going to take questions at the end, so we're sure to give equal time to both of our speakers.
Representative McFarland. I hate to be so naive, but could you tell me what 185% of poverty would be in dollar amount?
Dr. Mueller.
My guess is it's around 30-some thousand for a family of four at present. In the low 30,000s for a family of four.
Thank you.
Okay, Dr. Mueller.
The next slide shows NAEP achievement results by race, ethnicity for whites, blacks, and Hispanics. For fourth grade reading in Minnesota, 43% of white students are proficient compared to 10% of blacks and 18% of Hispanics, including large gaps in proficiency, so indicating large gaps in proficiency by race, ethnicity. For eighth grade math in Minnesota, the gaps are even larger. 49% of whites are proficient compared to 9% of blacks and 10% of Hispanics. Compared to the U.S. overall, Minnesota whites do better, but for Minnesota blacks and Hispanics, it's mixed, sometimes somewhat better, sometimes somewhat worse than nationally, as you can see in the table. Asians are not shown in the table. Their results are more similar to whites, but still somewhat below whites. Data for American Indians were not available. Turning to on-time graduation rates, or students who complete high school in 4 years, 83% of white students in Minnesota graduate on time compared to 44% of black students. White students in Minnesota have a higher on-time graduation rate than white students nationally, but black students in Minnesota have a lower one. Data weren't available for the comparisons to other racial ethnic groups. Next, to return to St. Paul Public Schools data to fill out the picture a bit more. And these data are comparable to the ones you just saw in the sense that they also are for on-time graduation or graduation within 4 years. But the rates are also shown for other racial ethnic groups such as Hispanic, Asian, and American Indians. Note the large differences. So on-time graduation rates in St. Paul for white 75%, Asian 70%, and then blacks 48%, Hispanic 43%, American Indian 27%. It should be noted that many students who don't graduate on time do continue in high school. And so if you look, for example, at six-year graduation rates, you would have higher percentages. Overall, they would be about 10 to 15% higher than what you see there, but the gaps would be similar in terms of the how large they are. I just wanted to mention that on-time graduation rates for Minnesota are somewhat higher than in St. Paul. St. Paul has a much higher percentage of students from low-income families than state overall, which tends to depress the graduation rates. Statewide on-time graduation rates are in the 80% range for whites and Asians and in the 50 to 60% range for blacks, Hispanics, and American Indians. Census data from the year 2000 indicated that the percentage of whites and Asians with college degrees, 36% in each case, is about double or triple that for black, Hispanic, and American Indians. So blacks 19%, Hispanics 17%, and American Indians 11% for college degrees based on the 2000 census. The next slide shows the difference in on-time high school graduation in St. Paul by income level, again above and below 185% of poverty. And what you see is that the lower income students have a 57% on-time graduation rate compared to 81% for higher income students. This next slide shows the achievement gap in a little different way, taking both family income and race ethnicity into account in the same graph. It shows the percentage of St. Paul third graders who are proficient or meet standards in both reading and math based on the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment results in 2005. Remember that the NCDA criteria for proficiency aren't as high as what you have I showed you for the national test. Each line in the graph represents a different racial ethnic group. Numbers are too small here to include American Indians. The left-hand end of the line shows results for lower-income students, and the right-hand end of the line shows results for higher-income students. Note that the line rises for each racial ethnic group, illustrating that the gap by income occurs within each racial ethnic group. However, note also that at each income level, there is still a substantial gap in reading and math between whites and other racial ethnic groups, roughly a 25 percentage point difference at each income level shown. Hence, even at the same income levels, there is still a large gap by race, ethnicity. Part of this gap is due to many students of color not having English as their first language. The next slide is essentially the same slide as the last one, but only for those who are fluent in English. Note that this is makes a big difference among Asian students who now exceed whites in proficiency at the highest income levels when we're looking only at students proficient in English. It makes some difference for Hispanics, but there's little difference among blacks, so the gap still persists, especially for blacks and Hispanics. Why are these gaps important? Students of color make up an increasing proportion of the K-12 population in Minnesota. In the first half of this decade, the K-12 white population declined while the students of color increased. This pattern of change has also increased the proportion of low-income students because students of color are more likely to come from low-income families. The K-12 students today will be the workforce of the future, hence populations of color will make up an increasing proportion of the pool of new workers available to employers in the state. An educated workforce is important in an increasingly knowledge-based economy. Thus, reducing or closing the achievement gap is linked to the state's future economic health. What contributes to the gap? So what are the factors that contribute to the achievement gap? Students from low-income families and racial ethnic minorities, in this case blacks and Hispanics, tend to have fewer of the following advantages. First, school factors. Teacher preparation. That is, teachers with certification that teach in their subjects, or at least a college minor in the subjects they teach, in schools that they attend. So schools that lower-income and minority students attend tend to have teachers with less preparation. Also, next, they have less of teacher experience, attendance, and stability. That is, teachers with more than 3 years' experience, low teacher absenteeism, and low teacher turnover, less likely for low-income and minority students. Rigorous curriculum in high school, that is, taking classes needed to prepare adequately for college or other post-secondary education and advanced placement classes, less likely, again, for low-income and minority students. Small class size, fewer than 25 students per class, less likely for minority students. Technology-assisted instruction, access to and use of computers and internet in the classroom, less likely. And safe schools, little or no fear of being attacked, no gang present, again, less likely for students of color or low-income students. Next, other factors that contribute beyond school-specific factors. Again, low-income families and racial ethnic minorities tend to have fewer of the following advantages: parent participation or involvement in their learning, and parent availability in terms of living with two parents. Second, reading to young children daily, especially 3 to 5 year olds, and limited television watching, less than 6 hours a day. Three, student stability, rarely changing schools. Fourth, adequate nutrition, not going hungry, and absence of lead poisoning or having low levels of lead in the blood. These factors have been quite well established by research. Certainly other factors may contribute to the gap as well. For example, high concentrations of children from low-income families in the same school, lack of summer and after-school learning opportunities, racial discrimination, and school funding disparities are other factors that have been discussed as potentially contributing to that gap. Next, how can we turn now to the question of how the gap might be closed. As noted before, the gap actually begins long before the child enters school. Hence, we need to start early for disadvantaged or high-risk children before they enter kindergarten. Research has demonstrated that high-quality center-based preschool programs, especially for economically disadvantaged and minority 3- and 4-year-olds, can make a difference in closing the gap. Some research also has shown promising results for full-day kindergarten and over half-day kindergarten. In this regard, full-day kindergarten can improve academic performance at least to a moderate or modest degree over half-day kindergarten. And I think you'll be discussing that more later. Now, turning to school things or school factors that can contribute to closing the gap. Besides quality early education programs for high-risk children, the research evidence for closing the achievement gap points to specific school-related factors. Not surprisingly, a strong core academic program in schools is crucial. Such a program includes the following: a strong focus on teaching and learning. That is, the instructional program is at the heart of what the school is about, and instructional time is protected against intrusions or distractions during the school day. Second, a challenging, rigorous curriculum for all students. Teachers have high but realistic expectations for all students. Students have a rigorous curriculum in elementary school that prepares them to take rigorous or advanced courses in secondary school. Alignment of curriculum, instruction, standards, and assessments. Teachers, students, and parents all know what standards students are working to reach. Students are assessed on their progress in reaching those standards, and results of assessments are used to inform instruction. Next, a strong teacher professional development program and culture of learning. Teachers receive training in delivering the curriculum effectively. There is strong follow-up to that training as teachers implement what they have learned in the classroom, including coaching and feedback to the teachers. The atmosphere among teaching staff is one of professional respect, good communication, teamwork, and collaboration. And finally, effective leadership. The leadership focuses primarily on instructional excellence with lesser focus on administrative or other issues. So those are kind of factors in the academic program that make a big difference in terms of academic achievement and closing the achievement gap. There are some comprehensive school reform programs that bring together many of these core elements just described, such as instruction, assessment, teacher training, classroom management. The best of these models have boosted academic achievement and reduced achievement gaps. Examples of some of the leading models that you might be familiar with include Success for All, Direct Instruction, School Development Program, and America's Choice, to name some. A common problem with these models is that they don't get implemented fully or with fidelity at schools for a variety of reasons, and consequently their impact is often not fully realized. Additional factors, the next slide here, if a school has the core elements just described in place, or most of them, there are some other factors that can further help in boosting achievement and closing the achievement gap. First, well-qualified teachers. Good teaching is especially critical for children at higher risk for academic problems. Research affirms that teacher effectiveness is a major factor in students' academic growth from year to year. Ensuring that students in high-poverty, high-minority schools have excellent, well-prepared, and experienced teachers could make a big difference in closing the gap. Often, these schools have less prepared and less experienced teachers. Second, small class size can make a positive difference, small in terms of 15 to 20 children per classroom. It can especially make a difference in the primary grades, K to 3. To benefit, children need to have small class size for at least 2 years during the early elementary grades. Research results show that minority students and students from low-income families benefit the most from small classes. Small class size tends to result in higher engagement of students, fewer discipline problems, and students receiving more individualized attention from the teacher. Third, attending smaller schools can be beneficial. Students who attend small schools, such as elementary enrollments of 150 to 250, middle school enrollments 300 to 400, or high school enrollments of 450 to 600, tend to have higher achievement. Low-income and minority students appear to benefit more from small schools. But in urban areas, students with these characteristics are more likely to attend large schools. A current approach called schools within schools aims to create small school characteristics within large public schools by dividing them into smaller autonomous groups. Proponents believe that the benefits will be similar to those for small schools, although this has not been established to date. And next is individual tutoring for students in need. One-on-one tutoring that supplements the regular curriculum can help improve student achievement. It is most effective when it is provided early to students in danger of falling behind and delivered by licensed teachers. This approach can be effective, but not necessarily, as a recent Minneapolis study showed. It needs to be delivered well for sure to be effective. Student family and support services can be helpful in reducing or eliminating conditions that interfere with a child's learning, such as behavioral and health problems and family stresses and instability. And finally, increasing parent involvement can make a difference in improving student achievement and potentially closing the achievement gap. Research indicates that parent involvement intervention programs in which parents participate in academic activities with their child outside of school can improve their child's academic performance in school. The evidence from the research suggests that such programs are most effective in the area of reading skills. To conclude, I would like to return to the importance of closing the achievement gap. Changes in the economy and the types of jobs needed and changes in the characteristics of those entering the workforce toward increasing racial and ethnic diversity are raising the stakes on the education achievement gap. For our reason to thrive, we will need an educated workforce. The impending retirement of the baby boom generation gives special urgency to the issue, as many educated workers will be leaving the workforce. Today's school demographics are tomorrow's workforce demographics, so the workforce of tomorrow will be increasingly made up of those having less success in school currently. Hence, closing the achievement gap is important to our region's future prosperity. Not only can these future workers not afford to be left out of the educational success, but the region cannot afford for that to happen. Or we could face major shortages of educated workers in the near future. This is made more likely by the fact that the school-age population isn't expected to grow much in the next 20 years in Minnesota. The number of high school graduates in Minnesota is actually expected to decrease slightly in the next few years, 5 to 10 years. Closing the achievement gap won't be easy. It will require highly effective public schools and preschool programs, but the schools cannot do it alone. Strong support from families in all sectors of the community will be needed. A couple of important areas to focus on are, first, early childhood, pre-kindergarten to third grade, to ensure that all children get off to a good and fair start, and the gaps are as small as possible during these early years. And second, getting more high school students, especially low-income and minority students, to complete the classes that are needed to be prepared for college or other post-secondary programs, especially math classes. These two areas are related, as students need to succeed in their early school years to be ready to take more challenging classes when they reach high school. And I think that concludes my presentation. So,
thank you very much, Dr. Mueller. You finished 5 minutes early. Right. And members, we're going to take a minute to approve the minutes. But first, before we do that, we're going to have questions for Dr. Mueller up till 3 o'clock before we go to Dr. Heistad. And if anyone wants to be recognized, as long as we have people talking, and I'll be trying to pay attention to that, for the new members, you need to get the attention of the committee administrator, Shannon Patrick, who is going to be writing your names on a list, and then I will call on you in the order that she writes you down. So you don't need to wave your hands in my face. You need to catch her eye, and you don't need to say anything, but you do need, it's your responsibility to make sure she nods at you and you see her writing down your name. because otherwise you can't complain that you didn't get called upon. You have to be on the list, and it's going to be in order. But before we do that, I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes of January 11th that are in your packet.
Okay.
The minutes have been moved by Representative Hillstrom. Are there any corrections to the minutes? Oh, a quorum is present now. I forgot to say that before we can do. That's why we didn't do the minutes at the beginning. We have a quorum, and now we're doing the minutes. And Representative Hillstrom has moved them. And I don't hear of any corrections. So all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved. Okay, now we have a lot of questions for Dr. Mueller, and the first one is Representative Demmer. And remember, we have right now 5 people on the list. I'm sure the list will grow. We have it up until 3 o'clock, just to give people a framework. Representative Demmer, almost have you being doctors today.
Not yet, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Mueller, I have a question. It involves one of the slides. I guess these aren't numbered. It's on one of the what contributes to it, the first of those.
Yeah.
Students from lower income families and racial ethnic minorities tend to have fewer of the following advantages. And then it lists the school factors. And I guess my question, we're talking about a gap where we have, the graphs show white and maybe Asian Pacifics are higher than maybe black and Hispanic and that sort of thing. Why wouldn't those factors affect the whites and Asian Pacific as well as the others? Why would these school factors affect one more than another? And then the gap be there.
Dr. Mueller.
Well, these factors affect both groups. It's just that the white students, for example, would have, in the schools that they attend, would have more of these factors, whereas the schools attended by black students or Hispanics or American Indian students tend to have fewer of these factors. So, for example, the teachers tend to be less prepared in the schools that blacks and Hispanics attend compared to whites. Looking at trends overall and rigorous curriculum, for example, less likely to go to schools that would have that in high school. Smaller class size, more likely in higher income and white students attend than lower income or racial minorities attend. So that's the differences that are being talked about. Really, on these items, there are differences in terms of having the more desirable aspects of these characteristics.
One follow-up, Representative Demmer.
I'll be right quick. Thank you, Dr. Mueller. Would you be safe to say you think that maybe in a, because I think you're right, I would agree that schools that have these characteristics probably have lower performance students in general. Mm-hmm. But the fact the achievement gap would be there, do you think maybe it's because others maybe can overcome some of these obstacles better than others or something like that?
Dr. Mueller.
Well, I can't really speak to this based on that. I'm really with regard to these factors, they're really ones that white and higher income students are more likely to have. And so whether certain groups of students take advantage of these more than others, I mean, I really don't have the data to respond.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the items, or two of the items that you've said about closing the achievement gap is early education and all-day kindergarten. But what about the kids that we already have in the system that are maybe in high school or middle school or high school? What are some of the options that we have there to help close that achievement gap before it's too late?
Right.
Dr. Mueller.
So those are kind of the factors that I listed after the early, on those slides after that. So I think, if you go back to those, the kind of things that can really help kids in elementary, middle, and high school are a strong core academic program that includes the features that I described in terms of the strong focus on teaching and learning, the challenging curriculum, this kind of alignment of instruction with testing or assessment, and then and the testing and curriculum being lined up with the standards, and then the loop in terms of using those test results to help shape instructions to make sure students are getting skills in the standards that are being are the goals, that kind of thing, as well as, I mean, I think teacher training or teacher development, so teachers are able to deliver the curriculum effectively or more effectively, is certainly a critical issue. And but in addition to that, I mean, these other factors that I mentioned, well-qualified teachers is really critical, and the fact of the matter is the best qualified teachers often are not in the schools with high numbers of low-income and minority students. So that's I think that's a big factor, and if that was changed and you had your best teachers in those schools where the students need it most, and those tend to be low-income and minority students, that would make a big difference. Small class size, maybe not so much in middle school and high school, but certainly at an elementary school. And, of course, parent involvement, whatever you can do. I mean, I think it's more helpful at the elementary level. It's a little late later, but it can still make a difference in middle school and high school as well. So those are some of the areas that certainly could make a difference for students beyond their early childhood years.
You've got Representative Dabney, Benson, Garofalo, Dietrich, Detmer, Ansel, and Dominguez. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking, sir, at the what contributes to its slide and other the other factors, the non-school factors, the non-directly school factors. And it just raises the point in my mind that while we talk about this as a academic achievement gap, it's really about an achievement gap that's much broader than that in terms of differential income across racial groups, differential housing opportunities, health disparities, a wide variety of things. Last year, I'm sure you may recall, we got a brief look at the Itasca Project's Mind the Gap study that talked about just how ethnically and economically segregated Minnesota is, particularly the metro area. And I'm wondering, sir, if are you aware of any programs around the country that look not just at the school and small class sizes, teacher training, that sort of thing, but attempt to come at the achievement gap in broader community-based initiatives?
Dr. Mueller.
Yes. I mean, there's some even locally. For example, I'm involved in evaluating a project that looks at the issue of stability related to housing and this is at Johnny Jensen Achievement Plus School in St. Paul, where there tends to be high student mobility, often linked to the problem of affordable housing in the attendance area of that school. So there's an effort to work with families to try to improve their housing situation, get them into more affordable housing that will stabilize their situation, and therefore stabilize their family and their student in terms of being able to stay in the same school rather than moving around because the family has to move around to try to get housing that they can afford. So that would be one example of that kind of effort. But I think I talked about just generally student and family support services as being a potentially helpful factor in closing the gap, and everything from trying to make health care more accessible to low-income and minority students. For example, Dayton's Bluff School in St. Paul, students can actually get dental services on site. And I think those kind of services that really provide, in this case, health care for students that wouldn't have access to otherwise can make a difference because health problems can interfere with learning and create greater absenteeism and so forth. So that would be another kind of example of a program that could make a difference. It's not really in terms of school-specific type of intervention.
Thank you, Dr. Miller. Thank you, Madam Chair.
We're clearly not going to get through the list. We'll get as far as we can. And people that are still on the list, if you can make your question fit to Dr. Heistad, I'll put you first for that next round. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Miller, when I was in the classroom, I noticed that regardless of ethnicity, parental involvement was the key, as far as I could see in my work setting. Have you found specific and concrete strategies that help encourage parents, many of whom had bad experiences themselves in public schools or in education, and for whatever reason don't want to show up, they are not superintending their children's studies. Have you found strategies that deal with that in specific terms?
Dr. Mueller.
Well, in my presentation, I alluded to some studies that there are kind of specific intervention programs around parent involvement, where staff from those programs work with parents to help give them the skills to work with their children on particular things that their children are learning, such as reading skills. And some of those programs have been shown to be quite effective in terms of when parents do go through a program like that, and then they work with their child outside the classroom on these particular skills. Studies have shown that an intervention of that kind can make a difference in the sense that students' reading skills in particularly have gone up in that type of research.
Representative Benson, follow-up.
A very quick follow-up. Are you aware of some of these strategies that, for example, the government in Brazil has introduced to encourage parental involvement? For example, adding economic incentives to families who see to it their children show up for school and whose parents attend teacher conferences, who superintend their children's learning, that kind of thing.
Dr. Mueller.
I'm not familiar with those studies that are providing incentives, I take it, to increase attendance or reduce absenteeism of students, but know of some programs locally where there's been an effort to work with families around the attendance issues to try to understand what's interfering with the students' attendance, and then trying to address those families address those issues individually with families, and aware of those, and if those programs were not so much incentive based.
Last question for Dr. Mueller, Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, who's next on the list after me?
I'm sorry.
Who's next on the list after me?
Oh, Representative Dietrich, Representative Garofalo.
Oh, she's smarter than me, so I'll yield my question to her.
That's very nice of you. Representative Dietrich, last question for Dr. Mueller.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom asked the first question that I wanted answered, and so I thank you for that. The other thing that I wanted to ask you is, when you talk about early education programs, you refer to high quality, and I see that term used both ways, high quality or just early education. And what did you mean by the words high quality early education?
Dr. Mueller.
A number of things there. One would just be the qualifications of the staff in the early childhood program, how well trained they are. Another factor would be how well supervised they are in the child care setting, sort of the structure of that setting in terms of the supervision. Another factor would be parent involvement. How strong a parent involvement program do they have as part of the preschool or other early childhood program? So those are some of the factors. I think there is an intent beyond the kind of quality issue. There's kind of the intensity of the intervention issue, so that it kind of needs to reach a certain threshold in terms of how much the child is attending the particular program in terms of, so 5 days a week, you know, that's going to likely be more effective than a 2 or 3 day a week type program. So those are some of the factors. My paper, I think, lists some others that maybe I'm not thinking of right now in terms of the, what I mean or what's meant by higher quality programs.
Thank you, Dr. Mueller, very much. I don't know if you can stick around for the second half of the meeting or not. We may or may not get back to having questions from you, depending on how many we have for Dr. Heistad. And if you can't, then we thank you so much for sharing your expertise. It's nice for me to know that a lot of the things you have listed here are not rocket science. They're things that are being done right now in very good schools, and we just need to ensure that they're done in all of our schools for all of our students and figure out what to do when they're not, and that's our challenge. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Heistad. And while he's setting up the his computer, and we're making a little transition, I will introduce David Heistad. He has worked for the Minneapolis School District for 22 years, and the past 7 years, he's been their executive director of research, evaluation, and assessment. He has a PhD in special education and a master's in statistics. Most of his work centers around school accountability and teachers that beat the odds. So that sounds very interesting. And when we were trying to figure out who to invite here for this topic of closing the achievement gap, the two gentlemen that we have were both recommended by many sources. And some people said that Dr. Heistad, in terms of testing and achievement gap issues, knows more than anyone in the state, that he's just the number one person. So now, Dr. Heistad, you have to live up to those glowing words that were said about you. And guess who said them?
Thank you much, Madam Chair. We'll be setting up here a brief PowerPoint presentation. My name again is David Heistad, Director of Research Evaluation Assessment, Minneapolis Public Schools. And my presentation will focus on the trends in learning gaps using the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments that we have given as part of the No Child Left Behind Accountability Act. And then following that, I'd like to address the question Dr. Mueller spent considerable time at the end, what factors really cause the gap to be reduced, what kinds of evidence do we have from local studies, Minneapolis and Minnesota, that the achievement gap can be reduced, and then I'd like to show you briefly some gaps being reduced in front of your eyes. So we have videotape of some of our best kindergarten teachers in Minneapolis that I think you will benefit from as well. So I'll keep my presentation brief so that we could spend a lot of time doing questions. Thank
and
you.
While we have the technical difficulties, I will just say that I really like Dr. Heistad's name and his spelling and pronunciation of his name, don't you, Representative Heidgerken?
I do. I really do.
Yeah. We Germans, you know, we like that EI and people that can pronounce it correctly instead of calling us Heidgerken or Greeling or Seifert and that sort of thing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Heistad is actually a place in Norway.
Oh, it is. Well,
yeah.
Well, clearly we know how to pronounce words right anyway.
but we like a German ancestry as well.
Madam Chair, when it comes to Norwegian and German, some of us feel strongly both ways.
That's a
Representative Mariani, do you have any announcements to make about your committee? Now's your chance.
Madam Chair, I was just trying to come up with something on my last name, but I couldn't think of anything.
Is it on now?
Yep.
There we go. Okay. We're all set.
Okay. Okay, Dr. Heisek, could you identify yourself then for the tape just right at the beginning here, since we had a momentary pause there?
Yes, Dr. David Heisted, Minneapolis Public Schools Director of Research Evaluation and Assessment. I'd like to give you the most up-to-date information that we have, including the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments from 2006. But I need to comment a little bit at the beginning that it's difficult to interpret the achievement gaps on the most recent assessments because we renewed the standards, we changed the standards, and we created some new assessments in Minnesota. And especially in certain grade levels, and I'm going to show you 11th grade math, we went to world-class standards. Dr. Mueller indicated that our standards were not as high as the NAEP standards, the National Assessment of Educational Progress. Well, now I think we exceed the NAEP standards in terms of our expectation for high school students in mathematics. The current standards, or the standards last year, were at about the 50th percentile, so I used to like to say that we were like Lake Wobegon trying to get all children above average. But now I think our standards are about the 75th or 80th percentile nationally, so we're someplace in the stratosphere. Most ELL students did not take the test, which complicates the analysis as well. The feds allowed us to give a special test that was designed for ELL students, much more appropriate for 1 year. Now they've withdrawn that approval, so we will be testing ELL students again this year, but they weren't included in these data, so that complicates things. But generally, the trends were positive from 2001 to 2005. For most areas in terms of narrowing the gap. Now, the 11th grade trends, we started using an 11th grade test in 2004. And you can see that there is a large difference between the percentage of students who are proficient in 11th grade math compared to Caucasian students compared to Native American students. So the gaps for American Indian students are very large. 47% of the students were at the standard in 2004 for Native American versus 75% of Caucasian students. But you can see in 2006 we upped the standards and all the scores go down. So now only 4.5% of American Indian students currently meet the high-level standards that have been set in Minnesota. Only 33% of white students meet the standard. So you can see there's a long way to go for all students, but especially for American Indian students at the state level. Similar graph for Asian students, and as Dr. Mueller indicated, the gaps between Asian and Caucasian students in Minnesota are relatively small. Asian students have a somewhat higher poverty rate than white students in Minnesota, but the performance levels in math are quite similar. There is still a gap of about 8 or 9 points. Hispanic students, there's an even larger gap. In 2004, only 40% of Hispanic students were at the standard versus 75% of Caucasian students. That gap reduced just a little bit in 2005, and then we have the new test. And only 10% of Hispanic students currently are meeting the proficiency standard on the new MCA 2 11th grade math test, 33% of Caucasian students. And finally, African-American students, where the gap is the largest. And I should say one of the reasons that the gap is the largest in Minnesota, or one of the largest in the country, is in part because our white students score so high. And generally, Caucasian students in Minnesota score well above the national average for white students. Our African-American students, however, score well below the national average for African-American students, and that creates this huge gap, which was 47% in 2004, reduced to about 45% in 2005. Now, it looks as if these gaps have been narrowed with the new test, but I don't think we should be fooled by that. White American students decreased from 77% to 33%, which is a 44% drop due to the new standards and the new tests. Well, you couldn't decrease 44% for African American students because they're only at 32%. So this is what statisticians call a floor effect. So you really can't go any lower. So first of all, we don't know whether the gaps last year were reduced or not. But from analyses we've done in Minneapolis, it seems like the performance levels stayed quite similar between last year and this year if you first take the last year's results and convert them to this year's standard. So it's kind of like in bowling. If you said that your basic standard or your MCA standard was 100 last year, and now we're saying it's 150. If we recalibrate last year's data based on the 150, turns out our math performance was very similar to last year. And actually, we saw an increase in reading. So don't be discouraged in terms of the performance of students. It's just relative to these very high standards now, we have a long way to go. I've got a couple of suggestions. One is we look at situations like this where white students actually show a decrease. And there are instances throughout the nation where people have claimed to narrow the gaps, but by having the top group decrease in terms of their performance. That's not an acceptable way to look at the gaps. And I actually suggest that we measure all racial ethnic groups' progress versus the high standard of 100% proficient. And white students have gaps as well when you look at the data that way. And we don't want to make the mistake of assuming that white performance is the standard. Obviously, in 11th grade math, white students have a large gap as well. The standards for MCA 2 reading actually stay quite similar. And so it's possible to look at the trends in third grade reading with a little bit more confidence that last year's gains are meaningful and that the gap actually is reducing a little bit. For third grade reading, we've seen the gap decline from 2001 until 2005 appreciably. So the gap was about 27% between American Indian and Caucasian students in 2001. It had narrowed to about 20% in 2005 and narrowed a little bit last year with the MCA2s, with fairly similar standards to 2005. So this is encouraging news. But you can see that less than 60% of American Indian students are at that standard. And so that's unacceptable. We still have a huge gap, and we also need to see the performance of white students increase as well. Asian students had a much larger gap in 2001 in the state. It narrowed to about 19% in 2005. Now, this latest data point in 2006 has confounding in it because the ELL students, the English language learners, were not counted in the MCA test. So you have to be a little skeptical about that data point. Same thing for the Hispanic students. We saw a narrowing of the gap from 34% to 30% between 2001 and 2002. That's very incremental progress for Hispanic students. Until the last year, between 2004 and 2005, we saw a greater increase. Again, the ELL Hispanic students didn't take the MCA last year. The African-American students is where the gap is the largest, as it was for 11th grade math, and we have seen some decrease in the gap over the last 5 years, from a 37-point gap in 2001 to about a 30% gap in 2005. And it looks like we narrowed the gap a little bit more in 2006 as well. The standards for the third grade reading may be a little bit easier, but it doesn't look like it's very, very much different from last year. So this is very positive news. What are some of the things that may suggest why the gap has been reduced, and what are some of those areas that really have the biggest bang impact for narrowing the gap further? We don't have controlled random assignment studies in Minnesota, at least yet, where you take half the schools and assign them to all-day kindergarten and half the schools and say you can't have all-day kindergarten, or preschool, highly effective preschool programs randomly assigned. We It's very difficult to do that. We haven't done that. But in Minneapolis, we have three areas of research that are showing that, as Dr. Mueller indicated, preschool is a really big area of impact. Increasing literacy preparation in preschool can have fairly substantial effects on entering kindergarten literacy scores. In Minneapolis, we assess students at age 3 using a preschool screener that includes some literacy items. And then we have a comprehensive beginning of kindergarten assessment. We've done some work with the Head Start program in Minneapolis and AmeriCorps Volunteers program through Serve Minnesota, and we put together a powerful intervention, having AmeriCorps teachers trained in the best practices in literacy. Then those students were followed into kindergarten, and we did see a significant effect in terms of the kindergarten readiness for those students. We have a slide here that shows that PICA is the name for the Head Start program in Minneapolis. The students that weren't in PICA had somewhat lower pre-literacy scores. 37% of the students were on track. The nice thing is we've been able to follow children all the way through third grade at the time they take the MCA. So we know starting in kindergarten where a student would have to be on our beginning of kindergarten assessment to predict doing well in third grade. We can predict with about 70-75% accuracy whether the student is going to be proficient. And in this case, 37% of the non-Head Start students who were matched with these students that were in the AmeriCorps program were proficient. 42% of the Head Start program's students were proficient, and 52% of the AmeriCorps-trained volunteer students were proficient. So this was positive news. We need to do a lot more investigation of what are the factors associated with this positive outcome, and we'll be doing value-added studies of the preschool programs in Minneapolis from here on forward. We're actually working with all the preschool programs in Minneapolis to try to get initial test scores, find out how the students do in kindergarten when they show up, get feedback to the preschool program on strengths and weaknesses, things that they could improve. So that's one area. High-quality preschool is paying off. I've done two studies in Minneapolis on full-day kindergarten. Both have shown dramatic effects for the students who need the impact the most. African-American students, Hispanic students, and American Indian students all showed greater effects with full-day kindergarten than half-day kindergarten. In addition, the schools that fully implemented the balanced curriculum in kindergarten, where you're training some skills as well as the fun activities, you've got literacy and you've got good writing, but you also have learning the sound symbol relationships. Those programs showed even higher success. So the combination of full day kindergarten with the full intervention showed the greatest success. And again, it was most dramatic for African American students who had the biggest gap and had the furthest to go. So that was encouraging results. And then I repeated a study last year of all-day kindergarten, and we did a matched sample analysis where I matched the students on racial ethnic characteristics, free and reduced lunch, English language learner status, special ed status. Girls always do better than boys. So we found an exact match for the students, and then found that the students in full-day kindergarten did significantly better than the students that were in half-day kindergarten.
Dr. Heisted, Representative Plistrom has indicated she has a question of clarification for right now rather than later.
That'd be fine.
Thank you. The question is about the white students and not having growth. Is that because these students already were ahead, or why is it that everyone else had tremendous growth?
Representative Pilstrom, I should have made that clearer. This is a value-added study, so it's the amount of gain greater than predicted. So white students made good gains. They made exactly what you would predict. African-American students, however, made much greater gains than you would predict. And that's what a value-added study tries to see. We make a prediction based on all the information we know about the students and typical performance. Do we beat the odds or not? And in this case, the white students did make gains, but but they only made what was predicted. It turns out that half-day kindergarten and full-day kindergarten for white middle-class students worked about equally well. But for African-American, American Indian, and Hispanic students, there was significant benefit to the full-day kindergarten. Oops, I need to talk about the last slide before I show you the videotapes. The areas of investigation that we're pursuing now in Minneapolis are following up on these full-day kindergarten studies and looking at literacy impacts and math impacts with methodology I've given a little example of already. It's called value-added, where you try to find the teachers in the schools that are beating the odds, showing the greatest progress for the students who typically make the least kind of progress. This is not unfamiliar to you in the legislature. I know that you've had Dr. Sanders in from Tennessee and have been looking at value-added models and have created a law that encourages us to do value-added. In Minneapolis, we've been doing it for about 10 years. And the way I use it is to find those teachers that make tremendous gains, go into the classroom, find out what it is that they are doing. And this last year, we actually videotaped these teachers so that we could share with our colleagues in Minneapolis what great instruction in kindergarten looks like. And then I presented this in national conferences, and I'm glad to have an opportunity to present to you three of the videotapes. We have we picked the 10 top teachers, 10 teachers that beat the odds, and 8 of the teachers were bold enough to let us into their classrooms and to videotape their instruction. I'm not as technologically sophisticated as I should be, so I have to end this and then go to the videotape.
While you're doing that, Representative Dietrich.
Chair, can we get a definition of value-added?
Yes, value-added.
That's a high step.
Yes, my definition of value-added, I think it's similar to Sanders, would be performance that exceeds expectations. So mathematically, you can define expectation as 1 year's growth in 1 year's period of time. So if you're at the 50th percentile last year, you would be at the 50th percentile this year. That's a simple form of value added. If your percentile rank goes up, you've increased. The more sophisticated models try to control for all the factors, demographic factors about students that we really have no control as educators. So I control for free and reduced lunch and ELL and special ed and racial ethnic factors and gender. I've controlled for intensity of poverty in the school. And once you set aside all those variables, what's left over, you hope, is instructional effect. If you've controlled for all the important variables, then it's the teacher effect that's left over. So it's the beating the odds, having performance higher than projected or expected, which is the value added. It's very similar to a gain. It's just a little bit more sophisticated.
And after we see these videotapes, we'll go back to the list, which is Representative Garofalo, Detmer, Anzell, and Dominguez, and then anyone else that wants to get on can signal to Shannon. Anyone that's question doesn't fit, Dr. Heistad can pass. But Dr. Mueller is still here as well.
Oh, I really wish that this was working right now. This is a teacher in Lindale School, 85% poverty, 85% students of color.
The capital letter. Where would you find the capital letter? And what's the At the end, and all, let's see, it's February, so let's do a heart around the period. You can't make a heart, you're welcome to make a circle.
Yay!
And there's one more thing that we're looking for in our sentences. Raise your hand if you know what it is. Jane? We talked about our period. We talked about our capital letter. Finger spaces, you're right. If you have finger spaces, give yourself a little kiss on the brain. And put a little dot in your finger spaces so you know where they are.
This teacher was our number one teacher in terms of value added. She did a lot of journaling. And this classroom is 90% poverty, 90% students of color. And the teacher, who was a male teacher, has taught these children how to do peer tutoring. Same age. They're doing letter sounds.
Can you teach me how to fly?
Good. On the air.
I'll stop it there. It is really amazing to see children reading that well in kindergarten in March. And Shingle Creek is one of those schools, again, with 85% poverty, 85% students of color. So all of the teachers that we found, using the data that we have in Minneapolis on beginning and end of kindergarten, gave examples of the best practices in literacy. Now, these teachers got together and did a training video that has been shared with all of the kindergarten teachers in the district. And the next piece is I'd like to see teachers like this, not just in kindergarten, but throughout the grades, have some incentive to move into the schools that are, you know, on the list of really needing intensive instruction. So in general, I'd like to see teachers that beat the odds, as Dr. Mueller indicated, work in some of the very, you know, highest need schools. But this kind of research has been has verified what the research nationally has shown, that balanced literacy, starting early and very positive reinforcing kind of environment, this isn't what they do all day. But during this period of intensive small group instruction, they do learn a lot. So be glad to take any questions you have.
Thank you very, very much. And just for members who are not on Representative Mariani's committee, which is a lot of you, we heard similar things this morning from the Robbinsdale School District and the Rochester School District. So it isn't just Minneapolis, of course, that has the achievement gap. But we appreciate Dr. Heistad. He's really smart on this achievement gap stuff, but technology. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is directed to Dr. Mueller. On one of your slides, it talks about how we can close the gap and a strong core academic curriculum program. You had one statement here, challenging, rigorous curriculum. Do you ever come across or did research on relevant curriculum?
Did you say relevant?
Relevant.
Dr. Mueller.
I'm not familiar with that.
Okay. Thank you.
Dr. Heistad.
I think what you're referring to is making the curriculum relevant to everyday life experiences.
That's correct.
And I think in mathematics there's been a lot of work to try to make these word problems really make sense in the world of the teenager. So a lot of the curriculum improvements, I think, have been in that regard. In reading, the research shows that relevance is important, but so is paying attention to the level of the difficulty of the text. And if we give, text to a child that's way above their head, even though it's relevant to everyday life, it won't be accessible and they'll have a difficult time with it. So paying attention to what the student enjoys to read, as well as the difficulty of the text, you get a big bang for the buck.
Representative Anselt.
Thank you, Madam Chair and gentlemen. The poverty factor just jumps out at me in all of this discussion. And I'd be curious to know, in your experiences, do you know of any successful attempts at interdisciplinary approaches involving social services, public health, nursing, other professionals in the community dealing with children from a more holistic point of view? Do you know of any of those efforts, and are they, does the data show that they are worth pursuing? I guess that's the question.
Okay. Dr. Mueller.
Yeah, I'm familiar. In fact, the Wilder Foundation has been a partner with the St. Paul Schools in a project called Achievement Plus, and that's in three elementary and then now middle school. And that really is a program that has they talk about three components. The instructional reform is one. Learning supports, which is more what I was referring to as student and family support services, and thirdly, extended learning, which would be the before and after school and summer school kinds of programs. So it's kind of, I think it's more holistic. The idea is really to try to address the needs of students from low-income or poverty families at multiple levels. And some of the examples I was using before were taken from Achievement Plus in terms of, for example, in the health area, trying to address health needs by, I was mentioning the dentistry and the dental screening that occurred. There's also a nurse practitioner in those schools, so they can get prescriptions and more health services right at the school setting. There's mental health services as well as more preventive kind of mental health programs, for example, at the youngest kids, kindergarten, first grade, and so forth, that are having some problems in the classroom, and just in terms of adjusting to the classroom, then there's a program where they work with called the Primary Project, where they work one-on-one with those students to improve their adjustment to school, so that kind of thing. And then there's a variety of things that they do in terms of working with families, and I mentioned the housing program at Johnson School in terms of working with families that are having issues around affordable housing to try to secure more desirable stable housing for those families. So that would be an example. And in addition to kind of these extended learning programs that occur before and after school, that in addition to an academic component, try to provide more enrichment activities that these students wouldn't get normally, that more middle class kids might get in terms of field trips and that kind of thing. So, I mean, that's an example of kind of a more comprehensive program that tries to address some of the factors or things that poor kids don't have compared to more middle class kids and try to address that multiple levels.
Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions. One is mine, and Representative Daphne had to leave, so he gave me a question. Maybe we can...
You have two, Representative Dominguez. First one.
First one is my question. I'm going to go back to the achievement gap, the closing. You mentioned that well-qualified teachers in the school system. If we know that that's a factor, what do we have to do, or could you give your advice on furthering qualified teachers that can teach in the Minneapolis-St. Paul district? How do we keep those teachers here, and you know, what do we need to do to sustain those students that can stay in the classroom with good teachers? Could you give me more advice on
Dr. Heistad?
In Minneapolis, we find that as Dr. Mueller mentioned, the highest poverty schools with low achievement also have the highest turnover of staff, and especially in middle school, we were finding that the teachers that were being laid off were the younger teachers with low tenure, tended to be more diverse, and arguably could have become some of our best teachers. So it's difficult retaining teachers, especially in the time of decreasing enrollment. Minneapolis has had 15,000 decrease in enrollment in the last few years. But we're working with the union to try to protect the staff that are working in the high need areas, and we are working on this idea of having the most not necessarily the most tenured teachers, but the most effective teachers working in some of these high concentration areas. Staff development is needed. Very few of the students who come as teachers had thorough grounding in what it's like to work in urban environments in their undergraduate programs. And so intensive assistance, not only in reading and math, but behavior management and all sorts of key aspects needs to be part of this program to develop really highly qualified teachers.
And Representative Daphne's question.
So Daphne's question, he wrote to Dr. Heisman, what impact concentration of poverty has on achievement? Because you mentioned the value-added research.
Yes.
Is that a factor, or is it an important factor enough to set aside, or how important is it?
Dr. Heisted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
When I've done value-added analyses, I have entered in a coefficient for concentration of poverty, which was, significant in some of the analyses. And the biggest factor is individual student poverty. But we also find that concentration of poverty can be a factor over and above that. We find that some of our most successful schools in Minneapolis with students of color are schools with a lower, in Minneapolis low would be 40% or 50% poverty, but schools that are not at the 90% to 95% poverty are showing in general greater gains for African American and Hispanic students.
Dr. Heisted, a question from myself, and then we have a couple other people on the list here. How many of Minneapolis schools now have all the kindergarten, and what percent of the kids are in those schools?
Well, we've invested significant district dollars over and above what the state gives us so that we can offer all-day kindergarten to all of our highest poverty schools. So there's one all-day kindergarten in every school in Minneapolis. But low-poverty schools tend to have one all-day and two half-day. So the exact percentage, I'm not sure, but I think it's around 70, 75. Jim Grathwell from our district would know probably better.
Okay, well, he can follow up with us if that wasn't, if that wasn't right, but I'm sure you've got a pretty good ballpark figure. And then my second question is, who decides who's going to get the direct instruction method of teaching? Is that up to the teacher, or is there some more systematic way to decide that one teacher that was using that method?
Yeah, in each of the cases, the teachers had been involved in specific staff development that was made available. One of the challenges is that staff development tends to be optional, and so teachers who may already be excellent teachers, everyone's signing up to learn some of the, of course, the direct instruction is nothing new. This has been around since 1980. But in this case, one school was utilizing it significantly, and not just with the lowest achieving students, but for kids that really wanted to learn to read fast. In the case of the peer tutoring, that was a grant from the University of Minnesota. They have a research on this peer-assisted learning. Comes out of Vanderbilt. We're finding that it's highly successful, and we're hoping to replicate it in many other schools. Each teacher, though, pretty much designed their own instruction, from the in-service training that they received in the district. Teachers run with it, and they get passionate about their particular approach.
We have Representative Faust, Representative Morrow, and if we get to second questions, we have Representative Demmer as well. Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, if you look at the charts for third grade reading, we've had pretty good success in closing that gap. Yet when we get to 11th grade math, we really have not. Why do you think that is, that we're having success one place and not another? And when today's third graders, the 2006 third graders, move through and eventually get up into 11th grade, will we see that gap narrow there?
Dr. Heisted.
Excellent questions. The gaps in reading have decreased incrementally since we started state assessment, and I think in large part due to the emphasis put on in this state to balance literacy instruction, to getting good preschool programs, etc. We still have very large gaps, but they have been reduced. In 11th grade math, we haven't had assessments in high school until just recently, other than the college entry assessments that are given to all students. And so we're kind of new at finding out just how large this gap is. But in my estimation, we don't have the kind of rigor in all high school curricula that we need, especially in mathematics. So we've expected students to possibly master Algebra 1 by the time that they finish their high school education, but arguably Algebra 2 should be mastered before students are ready to move on. And so I think especially for students of color and students in poverty, we haven't had those students in high rigor classes, and we haven't seen the success that we need to see for all students.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Heisted. In contrast to the NC A2 testing. Does individualized growth assessments such as the NWA measures of academic progress, is that a valuable tool for identifying and assessing value-added education?
Dr. Heistad.
In Minneapolis and most of our western suburban districts, we use the NWA levels test, which were designed to measure growth. Basically, their main purpose was to identify how much value we're adding to each student's achievement. We find it very valuable as a tool for monitoring the success of interventions, similar to direct instruction, where you've got an assessment that's really sensitive to growth. It also has less measurement error than the MCA test, and is highly predictive of future MCA. So we use it for multiple purposes that go beyond the state tests. Fortunately, however, the state is committed to using value-added methods with the state tests as well. We should be able to start reporting out growth on the same students across time on the MCA test. The problem is they weren't designed to do that, and we're kind of forcing a different kind of a test to do that. But I think in combination, most districts find that the two types of assessment meet their needs.
Okay, we're out of time, Representative. Maybe you can catch them afterwards. And thank you very, very much for your valuable information. Meeting's adjourned.